Mets fans, I want to take a quick break from talking baseball and let you know about the next top prospect in building a smart home. Eufy Video Smart Lock E330 is that big-time new star prospect. The Eufy Video Smart Lock E330 is a smart lock, a 2K resolution camera, and a doorbell. It's three devices in one, triple the security. You know triples are rare in baseball, but not with Eufy. You can have everything in one device rather than install many pieces on your front door. It's not just for security, but also for convenience. Just the other night, I had tons of packages in the rain. Rather than fumble for my keys, I easily entered my home. This is big since I have four dogs who are impatiently waiting for me at the door. No more concerns about losing keys, and you could assign passwords to your family members. Worried about when your loved ones are getting home? Eufy allows you to see them coming back home via the integrated camera. Hey, Mets fans, this is a home run. I had a competitive product before Eufy, and it's the difference between a one-dimensional hitter and a five-tool player. Eufy is that five-tool superstar. Go to eufy.com, that's EUFY.com to learn more. Already sold? Go to Amazon and get your Eufy Video Smart Lock E330 today. Want to go to the store? Best Buy will have it starting around May 20th. Get complete control over your front door at ease with the Eufy Video Smart Lock E330 today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, April the 25th, 2021. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you get the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. Well, welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets podcast, and as I was preparing for this show, I was saying to myself, not a heck of a lot much different to talk about this Mets team than last week. We talked last week about weathering the storm, the weather, and you know the rainouts and the COVID shutdowns, and how it's so hard to get momentum, and then the Mets go out to Chicago and they basically play in sub-freezing temperatures like it's New Year's Day. And they get swept. And they come home and they have a nice series win against the Nats. But it's not any secret. It's been a choppy start. And this is a team that day in and day out has not even close to hit any peak on outside of some of the starting pitching. And the bullpen, which has been very surprising. There's nobody on the offense that's hit any kind of rhythm. There's nobody on the offense that's hitting, I believe, maybe J.D. Davis and Brandon Nimmo, who has cooled down a little bit, but has been off to a good start. There's really nobody that's hit their stride. Now, I saw some articles throughout the week as, you know, and every time the Mets go on a bad streak, you get a lot of pundits saying that the Mets are going this way, and when they're on a good streak, there's the other extreme. And throughout the first 2 months, as we try to figure out who the Mets are, who are the 2021 Mets, what can we reasonably expect from them, you're going to get that. I'm not here to talk about the Mets need an identity or any of that stuff, but more what I see, which is the good and the bad. And the bad is something that I wonder, is overall baseball, are we seeing a trend? And the bad is the offense. Are we seeing a trend down in offense? And I'll give you some examples of that in a minute. The good, I think, is still plentiful, and I'm not trying to be over positive, because I think the first good is that on a Sunday game, you saw the depth, where you could put an Almora, a VR, you know, maybe Kevin Pillar if you wanted to at some point, and you could sit a Jeff McNeil, and you could sit a Dom Smith, and potentially when he's slumping, sit Conforto. And you're not going to get high-level, you know, all-star performances out of these guys for sustained periods. But for a couple of weeks or for a series or even a day, you get well above league average performance. I mean, with Elmora, you get every bit the kind of defense that you wanted out of Juan Lagares, who showed that at times, had his slumps defensively, but he showed you value there. And Villar, who, you know, is a guy that I'm hot and cold on. I think he's going to drive you nuts because I've read a little bit for those that have watched them play over the course of a full season. He's going to make goofy defensive plays and what have you, but he's got speed, he's got a live bat, and he's a guy that when McNeil, as he's slumping and he sits, I don't think there's a huge downgrade offensively in a small sample size. The bullpen has been much better than I expected. We all know about the bridge right now. The Castro-May-Diaz bridge has been really good, and it's only going to get better when Lugo comes back. And you could even, if these guys continue that, and Castro to me has been the biggest surprise because I was the most critical of him. And he pitched out of some trouble yesterday, and he got squeezed a little bit too. So, you know, some of that trouble wasn't all his fault. But you can ease Lugo back into leverage if these guys are this good. And quietly, the secondary guys, Familia, Gazelman, now you have Reed Foley, Sean Reed Foley coming in being impressive for three innings. Those guys potentially can eat quality innings when you're down. You saw that with Gazelman and Reed Foley. Maybe you come back. And they give you some depth when, you know, you don't have to always go in situations to Castro, May, and Diaz. You could pick your spots where you could hold a 4-run or 5-run lead with some of these guys. That's where you got into trouble in 2019. If the game was within spitting distance, 4, 5, maybe even 6 runs, you had nobody that could give you any kind of ability to get through an inning. So if that's with a bullpen, and in a way, if you look at the stats, the bullpen's been better than the rotation because the rotation, everybody's had a stinker except for DeGrom, and we'll get to DeGrom. We got to go a whole segment on DeGrom. But they've been very good. I still worry about the back end with Peterson and Lucchesi, but it sounds like Carrasco's progressing as well as Syndergaard, so you just have to get through another 6 weeks or so. Where's the bad? Well, the bad is the energy at times, and it really goes the energy on offense. And to a certain degree in Chicago, what worried me a little bit is, and it was symptomatic with that dropped pop-up, where I think it was Conforto and Kevin Pillar and McNeil converted, the pop-up dropped, and to me, I said, you know, that's the first sign where a team doesn't look confident, doesn't look energetic, and those are the things that get managers fired. And I'm not here to say Luis Rojas deserves any kind of mega attention on this podcast because we have no ability to assess Luis Rojas in any way, shape, or form other than in-game moves. And as our friend, Medellin Mets fan, has pointed out, he's been pretty impressed with him. You know, talked a little bit about Diaz coming in the new extra inning rules for 2 innings, kind of a way to try to win a game with your closer on the road, something that, you know, he broke it down where, you know, look, you put your closer in. If he loses, you don't really kill him because he's coming into an impossible spot. Because it's an impossible spot with a runner on second, you need a guy who misses bats. That's Diaz. And if he does well and goes 2 innings, he's a hero and wins the game. And I understand that. And, you know, he also talked about a little bit about what I just said is, you know, sitting McNeil, trying to get guys going. You can do that because the downgrade, it's there, but it's not huge. I mean, these are league average or better guys. So, you know, is that coming from the front office? I don't know. You know, probably some of it is. But look, a guy like Rojas has to answer to these guys. Not Zach Scott, not Sandy Alderson. They're not in the clubhouse. It's Luis Rojas that's the answer to these guys. And whether it's his idea, and I'm sure he's giving input, or he's the one communicating it, you know, you got to give him credit because if they're going to win, guys like Elmora and VR, they're going to have to play a little bit, and you're going to have to get them time because if they sit for 2.5 weeks, I don't care how much of a pro you are. I don't care how much batting practice you take, fielding practice. I don't care if they throw you down to the alternate site for a week. It's still not the same. And you know, I really, you know, the alternate site, I know there's games and they're playing and whatnot, but I just think the situation, the energy, all that stuff that comes with basically a fake game, I think it's almost like a workout. It's not a substitute for the real thing. So, you know, that's my thing. It's something to look at because the energy, I think, well, the discontent by the fan base and the concern comes from the very sleepy offense. An offense that, you know, may score 3-4 runs in an inning, but then go a lot of time without getting anything going. An offense that has not executed with runners on base. And to a certain degree, they won 4-0 yesterday. If they were in their sync, they should have won 6-7-8-0. I know they got a guy thrown out at the plate, but they're still not executing with runners on third and less than two outs. I don't always think they make contact when they should. Maybe that's who they are. Maybe that's the kind of hitters they are. I don't think so. I think that they're better than what they've shown in terms of execution. And I don't think they're going to hit last in the league in runners in scoring position all year. If they do, they're going to have a problem. And that tends to be a ebb and flow kind of stat. I don't know if you could really look at any trends. If this offense is bad all year and maddeningly inconsistent and frustrating, not much you could do. I mean, you can go out, you can try to bring Chris Bryant in, but look, your third baseman, other than his defense, is hitting. I mean, if he hits the way he's hitting J.D. Davis, then you don't got to worry about the D. You'll survive with the defense, and you'll bring in Guillorme late like they did yesterday, and that's what you're going to have to do, and maybe you spot him with some ground ball pitchers out there like Stroman, depending on, you know, the game, the situation, and what have you. You know, everyone's making a deal about the defense. The guys that are a problem at times, Nimmo and J.D. Davis, they're the best hitters on the team. They'll make up more for it. And I think that's way overrated. But where the energy and really where the concern comes into play is offense. But I started to look at the league, and the only a couple of little things to point out. First, the Mets have not really played a good offensive team yet. Philly, Colorado's okay, and they played in that environment, so you have to give them credit there. But Philly, Washington, Miami, all NL East division opponents, all right now bad offensive teams based on the numbers. Now, Washington didn't have Soto. Miami, I think, is, you know, got some interesting players, but I don't think they're anything special offensively. And Philly, of course, has some really good hitters in the middle of the lineup, where we have Muto and Harper and lesser extent Rhys Hoskins. But around that lineup, there's a lot of guys that you could pitch to. So maybe the pitching's a little overrated. You'll get a test here. Red Sox come to town, one of the best offensive teams in baseball right now. But if you look at the offense throughout baseball, baseball's down a half a run a game from 2019. A half a run. The levels you're seeing now, which is about 4.3 runs per game, are more towards the 2010, 11, 12, 13 level, levels we haven't seen in about 8 years, and specifically 2013. And I remember this because this was a big conversation. I remember going into the offseason where, especially with the Mets trying to figure out if they were going to go with Ike Davis or Lucas Duda at first base back then, the talk was it's hard to find 30 home run power, and Duda was one of those guys that showed that potential, as well as Ike Davis. You know, guys like Justin Upton were very valued because they could hit a lot of home runs because there wasn't the ability anymore. Offense post-steroids with testing had gone down, and you were starting to see a swing back. Now, the problem now is that if you do that now versus just 7-8 years ago, there's less contact in the game, so the product gets even worse. Because you can't go out and say, all right, ball, is this because of the ball? Is this because of weather? Is this because there's some players out, like Juan Soto? You know, is it schedule? I mean, is it an anomaly? I don't know. I mean, that's a pretty big drop, half a run a game. We're not quite a month into the season. What I'm saying is the Mets' offense dropping a little bit, and I think they're an extreme. I don't think the Mets, who are one of the worst offensive teams in baseball right now, are going to be one of the worst offensive teams in baseball. These are guys that I had pegged for 5 runs a game if they hit with runners in scoring position. And I still believe with a couple of big hits or runners in scoring position, those 4-0 victories become 7-run games. I mean, that's the difference right now. And it's going to be a lot of pressure. If this offense doesn't start to really get into sync, I think it's unrealistic to expect all these guys, and you saw it with Stroman on Saturday afternoon, to pitch to the levels where they have to shut a team down all game. I don't think it's realistic. Plus, as you get to better offensive teams, like they're going to see this week, it's not realistic. You're going to have to win some games 6-4. You're just going to have to. That's baseball. And I think they will. So it's really, again, a situation where it's a choppy start. I'm not ready to make any kind of declaration about this team, but I don't want to get too crazy about the energy on offense because I don't know where that's coming from other than when you don't hit, you don't look good. But the offense right now is what to look at because there could be some league trends at play here with the dead ball. Maybe it's strike zone. Way too early to tell. And look, you've got a number of guys who have something to prove and have some expectations and pressure. We talked about Lindor and Conforto. McNeil might fall onto that. You know, McNeil is a guy that now is expected to produce. He's now 3 years in the league. Dom Smith, no longer this prospect. He produced last year at a very high level. How can he repeat that? I mean, ask Pete Alonso. It's not always that easy. Even if McCann has a contract now, and although he's done some great things behind the plate, and I would have to give him some credit, along with Jeremy Hefner, for some of the changes that you're seeing on the pitching side, he hasn't really hit a heck of a lot, and what have you. So, again, not much different from a week ago, but starting to crystallize about where we could hone in on where is this team's opportunity. And I think if this offense is like this all year, I don't think going out and making a trade is going to help you. Unless, what do you say? You go out and Dom Smith's a bust, you move Nimmo to left, and you go get yourself a center fielder? Maybe. Too early to say that. Maybe. You know, you say, I can't live with J.D. Davis's defense as good offensively as he is, and you try to go get Chris Bryant? You know, I don't know if that's going to change a heck of a lot. And you're going to help the defense. So, really at this point, just something to look at, and I think that all things considered, this is a team that, based on their run differential, should be a lot worse. Should be like 6-10, maybe worse. So the fact that they're where they are, they're probably a little bit lucky, but it's a good sign going forward. So we'll continue to evaluate as we continue to be in the who are the 2021 Mets phase, and who is this team, and we'll continue to take a look. And another big test this week as they play one of the better offensive teams and a strong American League team as the Red Sox come into Citi Field. And they get a couple of days off, so the momentum continues to be also choppy, but soon enough, you're going to see them play quite a bit of baseball every day, assuming the weather and COVID stay at bay. And I think that flow situation will be addressed. All right, let's take a quick break. When I come back, Jacob deGrom, I know it was a few days ago, but it's important to look at Jacob deGrom. We've looked at Jacob deGrom in terms of context of how he is and the streak he's on. Went into it a little bit. Now, that game on Friday, where does it stand in Mets history? Is it one of the best games ever in Mets history? Well, it's close. You'd be surprised who's ahead of him. Not all of the guys who are ahead of him in their performances, but one in particular. So we'll talk about Jacob deGrom, that performance, and where it stands in Mets history right after this.
And Mercer goes down on strikes. Another double-digit strikeout performance for deGrom, the 49th of his Major League career. And Stevenson down swinging. And 100-mile-an-hour gas. 11 strikeouts for Jacob deGrom.
Here's the 0-2 to Harrison. Swung at and missed strike three. Got him with a slider way out of the strike zone. Down and away. Jacob deGrom has struck out the side in the sixth inning. And that's an even 12. And it looks like he's got a whole lot more in the tank.
And Jake gets him for the second time. That's 13 for DeGrom, 48 in his first four start, tying a Major League record.
Coming from DeGrom. Swing and a tip, strike three, as Tomas Nito hung on. That is the 49th strikeout for Jacob DeGrom. It is the most in Major League history for a pitcher through four starts in a season.
1-2. In there for a call, strike three. A career high 15 strikeouts for Jacob deGrom.
Delivers to Robles. Bouncing ball to short. Lindor charges, scoops it up, throws to first in time. Side retired.
And look at the response from the fans here. DeGrom stepped out of the dugout and got into the on-deck circle. They're thrilled.
Jake had an RBI double in the fifth inning to drive in the game's first run. And he lines this one in the right field and it's going to second hit of the night. He is just a phenomenon. You can have your Ohtani. Let's have their own two-way star.
Well, he's definitely the MVP of this game. He's done everything here tonight against the Nats.
Jacob deGrom has three complete games, including one shutout in his Major League career. He'll be bidding for both tonight.
Here's the pitch. Swing and a ground ball towards first to his left. Alonso has it. Underhands to deGrom in time. Put it in the books.
Jacob deGrom retires the last 19 batters. A two-hit shutout, 15 strikeouts, no walks, an unforgettable performance for the master of his craft. Jacob DeGrom rewriting record books tonight. He now has the best ERA for a career in Mets history. He passed Tom Seaver. Never better than tonight.
All right, we're back, and even a few days later, everybody's still buzzing about Jacob DeGrom's pitching performance on Friday. Complete game shutout, 15 strikeouts, two hits, and no surprise that the talk now, and it's been since really even before the season, about DeGrom's Hall of Fame candidacy, which I think is getting a little far ahead, but we could talk about it. And how long can he do this? I mean, he's in his late prime by getting into age 33 season. He's in his late prime when you start to look at how ball players age. And it seems like he's getting better. I mean, John Harper wrote a great column over at SNY. And, anybody, you don't have to be a scout. If you look at him on the mound and you see how effortlessly that 99 to 100 comes out of his arm. I mean, late in the game, you don't see any laboring. It seems like he gets stronger as the game goes on. And the most impressive thing I thought out of the entire situation is, as I'm looking at the pitch count, and DeGrom finished up with 109 pitches, I'm saying to myself, will they hold him to a hard 100? Now, I'm not a pitch count police guy. I mean, I personally believe a good top of the rotation, a 1, a 2, a 3 pitcher should go 120 pitches. I don't care what era you're in. I mean, the days of Doc Gooden, David Cone throwing 150, 160 pitches. I mean, I think it was a playoff game in Seattle. David Cone, I think, threw 155, 160 pitches for the Yankees. You're never going to see that again. The effectiveness clearly goes down as you get deeper and deeper into that 100 pitch, north of 100 pitch, and then tired, injury, things like that. Different era. I'm sure you could push some guys, but I'm not advocating for that. But 110 to 120 pitches, that should be an every game norm. I'm sorry. And it would eliminate some of the bad baseball in the middle innings with garbage middle relievers and guys that walk the ballpark. But that's an old hat story. Things aren't going to change. But I was looking for exactly how they were going to handle DeGrom, and I was so happy to see that they allowed him to go out that extra inning. Now, like I said in the beginning, something to look at going into today's action. Sunday's action, runs per game were down by about a half a run from 2 years ago. Early season weather, maybe, matchups, dead ball, is that part of it? The messing around with the ball, which is driving me crazy, because why can't baseball just leave things alone? Let the game play out. There's a lot of different things that, could come into play for the lack of offense. And the Nats are one of the worst offensive teams. I mean, the Mets, the Yankees, the Nats, all these teams are at the bottom of the league in scoring. Now, will that continue? I don't know. Without Juan Soto in the lineup, you may have to take a little bit of a handicap on the performance. But Colorado, Miami, Washington, I don't care who they are, how good those teams are. In this era of dominance where there is smaller ballparks, there is more offense, even though that offense is being criticized for being zero-sum gain, like a home run and what have you. There's a ton of offense. You're sitting in the midst. Like I said a couple of weeks ago, we're in the midst of an historic run, and everybody's talking about that. But where did this game stack up? So immediately after that game, I was thinking about the old Bill James game score. Now, you're probably familiar with it, but if you're not, the Bill James game score is basically a formula. And there's a couple of different ones. If you go to MLB.com, they'll tell you there's the Bill James game score, and then Tom Tango, another all-time sabermetrician, has come out with his own. Essentially, they give you points for each out recorded, more points for each inning completed after the fourth, points for strikeouts. They ding you for home run, earned runs allowed, hits allowed, unearned runs allowed, walks allowed. It's essentially like fantasy baseball. I mean, let's face it, there's fantasy baseball leagues. I remember CBS Sportsline used to ding you for walks and runs when they used to do certain pitching performances out there. I'm sure everybody's got different things that they use in their fantasy league. So it's like fantasy baseball, but it takes every game in the history of the sport and puts it on even playing ground. It is obviously going to favor strikeouts, which is going to favor pitchers in this era. So we'll put that in context. But I tweeted out on Saturday morning, and I was wrong, that DeGrom's performance on Friday, the 15-strikeout two-hitter against the Nats, was third all-time behind Seaver's 12-inning performance, where he got a no decision in 1974, where he went 12 innings. And then everybody remembers the other performance that was a shade better than DeGrom, which was David Cohn's 19-strikeout performance the last day of the regular season, 1991. Phillies swinging and everything, a masterful performance there. There is one other, and I didn't realize this. This is an interesting one. There's one other performance that is, as far as a game score, is better than DeGrom's performance on Friday, which fourth all-time. Now, remember, before I tell you who number one is, DeGrom's game on Friday was better than Seaver's game, the Jimmy Qualls game in 1969, better than Seaver's 19-strikeout game against the Padres in 1970. So remember that. And I'll tell you a couple other players that are showing up on the top 10 and who aren't showing up in terms of game score. Just gives you kind of a and puts in context some of these performances that we all know as longtime fans, we go back and go into our memory banks in Mets history. So Rob Gardner, 1965 Mets, last weekend of the regular season against the Phillies at Shea Stadium on a Saturday, pitched 15 innings. Yes, 15 shutout innings, struck out only 7 in 15 innings. By today's standards, it'd be like you should have struck out 25. But 15 innings, allowed only 5 hits, no runs, in a game that ended in 18 innings and was suspended because of curfew. I don't know why, because I think Shea Stadium had lights in 1964, but they suspended it because of curfew. Wound up playing a doubleheader the next day, which is the last day of the regular season. Mets lost both of those games, lost 112 games throughout that season. But Rob Gardner's game score was 112. So he's number one. The best pitch game, according to Bill James' game score, or Tom Tango, or whatever formula you want to use, the best game in Mets history, October 2nd, 1965. 15 innings, no earned runs. I'd love to see if we could get Rob Gardner on the show. I don't know where he is now. And talk about that, because that's an amazing performance. And I never knew about that. I mean, here it is. I've been watching the Mets for 1,000 years. I probably have run this game score before, and this one comes up. And I'm on Baseball Reference, so I don't know quite if I'm doing anything wrong here. But yeah, 15-inning game. The next best score would be a 12-inning performance by Seaver, like I said, on May 1st, 1974, against the Dodgers, a game the Mets lost 2-1. In extra innings, and then go on and on and on. Who else is on this game score? So the top 10, you're going to find this very interesting, because there's going to be a name. One name I think you're not going to be surprised about. But, of course, after DeGrom on Friday, you have an August 11th game against the Padres in 1971, where Seaver loses 1-0. We went 10 innings. The Mets lost 1-0. Seaver again in 1970 against the Phillies. Matt Harvey against the White Sox. You guys might remember this game. He did not, I believe, get a decision. The game went into extra innings, but I think that was the bloody nose game, if I'm not mistaken. I think at that point on May 7th, after that White Sox performance, 9 innings, 12 strikeouts, everybody was starting to realize that Harvey was legit. I think that was when the Dark Knight thing was starting to really pick up steam. Jerry Kuzman had a game where he went 10 innings, struck out 15. He's eighth on the list. Seaver's Jimmy Qualls performance in 1969, July 9th, 1969 is number 9. And number 10, R.A. Dickey against the Orioles, a one-hitter. I think that was in the midst of his back-to-back one-hitters. His Orioles performance at City Field, 13 strikeouts, 9 innings, only one hit. That's 10th all-time. Now, who's showing up right outside the top 10? I'm going to give you one name that's showing up that you might remember this game. It's a 2011 game. In 2011, in the midst of the end of a season where the Mets were going nowhere. And it's a couple of months before Hurricane Sandy. There was another hurricane, and I cannot remember the name of the hurricane in late August. But there was a hurricane. It was barreling down on on New York, the Northeast. And it was against the Braves, the performance. But Chris Capuano struck out 13 Braves in a 9-inning, 122-pitch performance. Mets win 6-0. A lot of ways it was starting to get windy and nasty, and I think the Braves just wanted to get the hell out of Dodge. But a game is a game. It counts. So Chris Capuano is, according to game score, the 12th best pitching performance in Mets history all time. And you want to know something? The no-hitter the no-hon, the iconic first no-hitter in Mets history, 49th all-time, a 90-game score. Now, he's getting dinged, Santana, because he walked five batters of that game. Take away some of the walks, it's a little bit better, and it starts to creep up a little bit higher in Mets history. But, you know, guys like Sean Estes, who had a one-hitter, better than Santana's no-hitter. Terry Leach, a performance in 1982, a 10-inning shutout. He's up there ahead of the Santana no-hitter. But so the point is, I'm getting a little off track here because I'm having fun with numbers. But it's fun if you could go to Baseball Reference and you subscribe to something like Stathead, you could go out there and you could see some of what is looked at in terms of statistically great moments in Mets history. Now, as far as DeGrom and the Hall of Fame, I'm not ready to start to get too deep into that because I think it's too early. But since 2014, now, if you go back to 2010, you want to do the decade of 2010 to 2020. DeGrom, from a wins above replacement, is eighth all-time. He didn't even pitch the first eighth of that decade, when I say eighth all-time. Eighth all-time during that decade. And he didn't even pitch the first 4 years in that era. Now, you take away and you start to do 2014 to 2020, you're not even counting maybe some of the performances this year. Only Max Scherzer's better. And if you want to put his performance in terms of wins above replacement into current Hall of Famers, DeGrom, he's going to fall in the... And let me go here. You put wins above replacement. He's got about 36 or 37 wins above replacement. I mean, right now, he's falling into that Catfish Hunter. Not too off of Jack Morris. Chesbro. I mean, you know, that's really going back. But if you want to see someone a little more contemporary, I think Catfish Hunter and essentially right after that, Jack Morris fall into that. A lot of relievers right now, he's right there in terms of win shares, the Bruce Gossages, the Lee Smiths, Trevor Hoffman, Raleigh Fingers, Bruce Sutter. Those are looked at completely differently. But if DeGrom pitches another 5 years, and this is where it really, you know, DeGrom's got, what, about 71 wins, and that's been the narrative. If DeGrom pitches another 5 years and averages 15 wins a year, 15, 30, 45, 60, let's say 4 years, another 60 wins, you know, maybe, you know, shave a win or two off. You know, if he could get another, 50 to 60 wins and get up to about 120, 130, he still would go into the Hall of Fame. And I'm talking about at an elite level, not at a league average level, because he's got to pitch maybe not all time, but very good to elite for the next 5 years, I think, to even be in consideration for the Hall of Fame. I think then you could, you know, have a bigger argument. I think you gotta let this thing breathe. You could speculate all you want about whether he could, because of his delivery, because he was a shortstop in college, whether he could pitch until he's 40. I think the next 5 years and how good he is, and he doesn't have to be like this good. He has to be really good to great. He's got to be right up there as one of the top pitchers, top 5-10 pitchers in baseball. Now, could he be great like this for 5 years till age 38, very much past the expiration date? I don't know. He's had a couple of surgeries. He had the ulnar nerve surgery not too long ago. Of course, he had Tommy John back when the Mets drafted him. So maybe the arm has been reconstructed and maybe it's in good shape. And I'm sure it sounds like, listening to everybody talk, he's such a smart pitcher. And it really goes to show you how between the ears is really what this is all about when it comes to pitching. That's what it's all about. You could throw as hard as you want. You could look at all the TrackMan data. You could do all the things that are out there that are at your disposal in terms of technology. But if you don't understand how to put all those tools together and work a lineup, not just throw your game, but work a lineup. Look at how the pitchers are reading you. Look at what their processes on the other side. You know, taking a lot of different things into the equation that are going on in the game, the ballpark, the situation. That's how you go from, you know, inconsistency to good and good to great. And I think that's what you're seeing with DeGrom right now. So I think it's something to watch. I'm not going to get too crazy about it. I know that the media is going to want to have this party every 5 days. I mean, look, this is just like Doc Gooden probably in 85. I mean, we're at that point where I think that's what they're expecting. We need to see more. I mean, he's not going to pitch to a less than one ERA all year. He's going to get hit. He's going to have games where he gives up three runs. I mean, you even saw in Colorado, the one thing you've seen so far is that they will run into one of those 99-mile-an-hour fastballs. You've seen Marlins ran into a couple of them. The Rockies ran into a couple of them. So he's going to give up runs, and he's going to have his down games. But I think you're in the midst of seeing him at his peak. And probably the best comp of the kind of Hall of Fame career, and he won't come close to the 200 wins, but Roy Halladay is probably the best comp. If DeGrom goes in, let's say with like 120, 130 wins, he would probably go in as one of the, he'll go in as the least amount of wins as a Hall of Famer, if that's how his career winds up in that 120 to 130 range. And he really will become, and this is so far down the road, if we're still doing this kooky show 10, 15, 20 years down the road, more than that, because you know you got to wait 5 years before he gets in, and we hope DeGrom has a very long career, another 7-8 years, whatever it may be. He'll go in as the poster child for modern analytics and the value of wins for starting pitchers. He will, unless there's another player that comes along in the interim, which right now I can't think of. And I know it'll be funny because the LOL Mets, they could never get the bullpen in check when he was on the mound, and the offense is always bad when he pitches. The antithesis of Seaver, which seemed to, they seem to step up. But you look at some of those Seaver games that I just mentioned that were on the list. I mean, so many games, you went 10, 12 innings. Mets didn't score, scored one run. So in a lot of ways, you're seeing some of the things that the Mets fans in the 70s went through with Seaver, with DeGrom today, with an offense that shouldn't be having trouble scoring more than 1-2 runs a game. But we talked about that earlier in the broadcast. So anyway, interesting stuff. I mean, we had talked about DeGrom 2 weeks ago. I thought we'd jump a little bit deeper into some of this. A lot to think about. Let's have fun with it, and let's see, and let's not put expectations on this. Let's sit back and see how high he can go, how good he can be. And, certainly pitching, like, to me is like art, is like artistry, and it's beautiful to watch when he's on. And it does. And let's see him against some of the top teams if he has a chance to pitch against the Dodgers at some point and what have you. Teams that really can score, it'll be interesting to see how that, all plays out. So, teams like the Diamondbacks right now, a good offensive team. We know about Atlanta. Teams like that, environments that are difficult to pitch and maybe are not conducive to low-scoring games. Let's see how he pitches there. Now, we saw Colorado, but it was also 30-degree weather, so keep that in mind. All right, let's take a quick break. When we return, Dave Jordan, author of the book Cobra, a new book about Dave Parker. Why Dave Parker? Well, there's a lot of Mets connections, and I think we'll also get into some of this Hall of Fame talk. And, a certain Met, Keith Hernandez, I think, falls similar to Parker in terms of a very good career that as we get deeper into the Hall of Fame discussion, and as, we look back at some of these players from the 70s and 80s, maybe we got to rethink about that as we learn a little bit more about stats and different eras and what have you. So, all right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back with that and more right after this.
So it's 2-2 with two out to Hernandez. And he hits it to right field. Parker going back. He drops the ball! Both runs score! Hernandez to second and the game is tied. Unbelievably, Dave Parker drops the final out of the ball game, and the Mets tie the game on the error.
Well, you see it happen once in a while, the one-handed catch. He tried to nonchalant it. Parker noted for that, and it cost him a ball game right here, at least at this point in the game. Reds had it wrapped up. All he had to do was catch it. It was not that tough a catch. But Parker with the one-hand showboat type catch. And he is there. It's a routine play right there, and he doesn't make it. Once again, another look at it. Off the heel of the glove. Parker looks in. No ball. The game tied. The go-ahead run at second, and Carter the batter.
We're back, and joining me, author of the book Cobra, Life of Baseball and Brotherhood. It's the Dave Parker memoir. Dave Jordan. Dave had a great book, Fastball John D. Quisto's book a few years back. And you might be asking, why Dave Parker on the Talking Mets podcast? Well, Dave Parker has a ton of connections to interesting moments in Mets history. And also, as we talked about earlier, with the Hall of Fame and Jacob DeGrom and how looking at the Hall of Fame is going to become harder and harder and different. Well, going back to the 70s and 80s, that's becoming harder because we have a lot more information now. So, Dave, welcome to the program. And congratulations on your second book, an interesting player in Dave Parker. But more importantly, I think you got to really relive a couple of special eras in baseball that I think a lot of listeners probably remember vividly, because those are the eras that they cut their teeth on in learning about baseball and growing up as baseball fans.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I appreciate you having me on here. Yeah, it was really an interesting thing and an interesting dynamic. I basically came off of the release of Fastball John, as you recalled. And Johnny and I had actually just gotten home from an event in Cooperstown celebrating the book when I had a chat with a close friend of mine who's close with Dave Parker. And he told me Dave was trying to get an autobiography off the ground. And he'd been trying working on that for about 15 years, had gone through three sets of writers. And he was basically like, you know, I'd love to see what Cobra's story would look like in your hands, which kind of made sense logistically because DeAquisto and Parker were born in the same year, graduated from high school at the same time, were both selected in the 1970 Major League Draft, and both made their debuts in 1973. So it was territory I was extremely familiar with.
Dave Parker is, if you look at his career from 74, and let's cut it off about 1987, when you start to look at the numbers, and you're a stats guy, and I was looking at wins above replacement. I mean, he's there with Reggie Jackson in terms of win shares, Tim Raines, Hall of Famers. What's interesting during that era, and I'm wondering as you were doing the book and going back and remembering those, you know, two decades with Dave, names that I was surprised that came up as some of the top, and we're talking offense here, hitters, Buddy Bell, Keith Hernandez, Dewey Evans, Bobby Gritch, not all Hall of Fame numbers, Jose Cruz, not all Hall of Fame names that come off the tip of your tongue. Were you, specifically with Hernandez, who I think is starting to get, at least here in the New York area, a look back of more consideration for the Hall of Fame? And I know we may be doing the Hall of Very Good at some point, but I think there's some nuance to that comment. Did you get a chance to look back at some of these players and get a different appreciation as you were talking to Dave?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny you should bring this up because I came across a stat that I thought would be an interesting talking point. You know, since Jackie Robinson broke the Major League color barrier in 1947, there have been 113 players with at least 9,000 plate appearances. And, you know, everybody in stats these days, they all talk about small sample sizes. You know, you got to have at least 7,500 instances for something to be, quote unquote, significant. So I came up with this statistic I found called the BRS percentage. And Mike Petrillo at a Major League, at the MLB Network, he talks about it rather often. The percentage of base runners who scored on the batter's play, not necessarily an RBI. Of those 113 players, Roberto Clemente was ranked 12. Al Oliver is ranked 6. Willie Stargell is ranked 5. Dave Parker is tied for number 2 on that list. And to me, that's not a coincidence. That was an organizational philosophy executed at the highest level by men of elite playing ability. You know, the Pirates in the 1970s were the third winningest franchise. In the absence of dominant pitching staff and as well as a middling defense, they were last in walks in both the 60s and 70s among legacy ball clubs.
Wow, that's interesting. And I was reading, and as I was prepping for this, there was on a website called The Comeback, talked about how the Pirates in 1979 with their championship team, you know, they weren't a powerhouse in terms of power and OPS and things like that, but they were able to score runs, and it was harkening back to maybe some of the debate. You know, Tom Verducci recently had an article out over at Sports Illustrated, the concerns about the flow of the game. You know, 6 runs a game is not all created equal. And look, I think if you're a fan of a good team like the Dodgers, you know, hopefully the Mets and Yankees, who are off to slower starts, become part of that conversation. I don't know if the flow of the game bothers you as much, but I definitely think from an aesthetic standpoint, you think of the Cardinals of the 80s, you know, the Pirates who you write about here, even some of the Mets teams of the 80s, good teams. It was a diversified offense. It wasn't all players that you had to have a shortstop in the lineup that hit 15 home runs and work the count. Some of the stuff that is, I guess, bread and butter things of becoming good offensive players in baseball is creating some of that, you know, glut. And I think as you talk to Dave throughout the book, you got a chance to, you know, hear about players that may not have been the sexiest names or the best players, but they knew how to play the game. And I'm wondering, you know, not just on the Pirates, if some of those names that come to mind as you know, were doing this project and talking to Dave throughout.
Well, it was amazing. And we talk about, you know, the Mets Pirates connection. The one player that comes to mind is Tim Foley. And he was a number one draft pick by the Mets. I think it was 68. And then he had a rather middling career, but he was known as a feisty player. and a decent shortstop. And the thing that always, I believe, held the Pirates back in those mid-70s teams, whether it was, you know, getting to the NLCS in 74 and 75, and then just coming up short against Philly those three following seasons, was that they had kind of weak infield defense, and especially at shortstop. And it's no disrespect to Frank Tavares, who managed to always make a dazzling play, you know, occasionally, but he would kind of have issues with errors. And the Pirates took a real shot, you know, the second, third week in the season. They traded their starting shortstop to the Mets for the Mets' backup shortstop at the time was Tim Foley. Now, Joe Torre, who was kind of in the infancy of his managerial career, took a shot and tried to play Doug Flynn at shortstop because he had a hunch about Kelvin Chapman, you know. And
Kelvin Chapman. Look at that. There's a name for the past. Wow.
Right? So the Pirates get Tim Foley, and he ends up having a career season. And he played perfectly, perfect Pirates artificial turf baseball. A lot of hit and run, a lot of turf singles, you know, setting things up for Parker and Stargell right behind him. And it was really a kind of a spectacular trade that when, you know, Parker talks about the So 79 Pirates, you know, the most valuable trade was obviously getting Bill Madlock, but the smartest trade was getting, or the smartest trade was getting Bill Madlock, but their most valuable player in many ways was Tim Foley.
Yeah. Those kind of component players. I know they traded him and look, I'm not going to complain about them trading him for a star like Lindor, but I thought Andrés Giménez was going to be one of those component players, you know, a guy that has speed, could make all the plays, not going to be sexy, not going to be more than maybe league average. I think Omar Vizquel was one of those comparisons, but I think that's exactly what you talk about with Tim Foley. You know, when you build the team, having those kind of component players is a big deal. Did Dave talk at all about how much baseball he watches now and his thoughts on the game? And, you know, there's so many different topics and ways you can go. Obviously, the percentage of African Americans participating is a big conversation. And the Mets have a couple of guys in Marcus Stroman and Dom Smith that are, you know, trying to spearhead maybe some more interaction. I mean, Dom Smith doing some great things to you know, back in LA to get more engagement from the youth. You know, what did he think about today's game and what were some of the observations that a guy that saw a lot in his career, what were his observations? Because he spanned into the early 90s when things were starting to change.
Yeah, I mean, he sees it as just a different game. And it's not so much a game that interests him as much as the other game. And they're really, it's such a funny thing because there's a lot more intellectual exercising with modern baseball than there was back then. But, and that's what drives him nuts, is that everybody's thinking about the game, but nobody's thinking about the game. The fundamentals are so far off. I remember I was at a card show, and I was in the hotel, and I was stuck on a line with Cookie Rojas, and, you know, to check in. And we're sitting there talking, and he basically says, I won't coach no more because there's no fundamentals at all, and they're not being pushed.
Wow, that's interesting. And when you think about the current game and what have you, and you look at some of the events that I didn't even realize that Dave Parker was involved with. So one of this, and this is all before my time, is the 1973 Ron Hodges game. You know, a lot of Mets fans remember the, you got to believe, 73 Mets. Yeah, they beat the Reds. Yeah, they went on to the World Series and nearly beat the A's. But there was some real exciting games that September. And maybe what was considered the turning point was a game where the Pirates and the Mets face off in late September. Ron Hodges gets a game-winning hit. But Dave Parker wasn't a starter in that game. He was a bit player, a young player at that point. But did he have any memories of that classic game where Ron Hodges walks it off? It was a play at the plate that Ron Hodges missed the tag, and the ball was rolling on the wall. It was one of those, you know, magic moments that 69 and 73 harkens back to.
He says you couldn't even hear yourself think with the crowd screaming as much as it was.
Wow.
And it just was incredible. And he actually went up and faced Harry Parker. It was Parker versus Parker. And, wow. And he ended up striking out, and the Pirates somehow, you know, they took the lead. It was a very tight game between Jerry Kuzman and Jim Rooker. Pirates take the lead in the eighth, and the Mets tie it up. The Pirates take the lead in the ninth. The Mets tie it up, and it goes till the 13th inning. and Richie Zisk is on first, and this other rookie that was sort of competing with Bark was named Dave Augustine, or Dave Augustine, and he hits this shot that's supposed to be a two-run homer. Everyone thinks it's a two-run homer. You know, Zisk is kind of taking his time around the bases, and it hits the top of the wall, and it's an epic drop into Cleon Jones's glove. He's got to throw the toss of his life. He nails Wayne Garrett, who throws a perfect strike to Ron Hodges, nailing him at the plate. If you can go on YouTube and put Pirates Mets 1973, you might hear Bob Murphy's call of it. And somebody put some lovely music behind it. It's just, it's a hysterical little clip. And it's a wonderful clip if you're a Met fan. And then the Pirates, the Mets ended up winning that game on a Ron Hodges single. It was like the Ron Hodges, you know, move of his life, a game of his life. And basically, you know, after that, the Pirates are still in first place, but they went back to the Essex house where they stayed that night, thinking about how we're going to hit Tom Seaver tomorrow. And the next day there was like 50,000 fans. Everybody was so juiced up because of that game the night before that they just filled the ballpark and they just destroyed the Pirates 10-2.
Yeah. As I'm listening to you, and there's so many more stories we'll get to, which again, you wouldn't think, and I have with me Dave Jordan, co-author of the book of Dave Parker's memoir, Cobra. As we're doing the storytelling, I think it's funny because, you know, I do this show, I've been doing this a long time, and, you know, the criticism that people get, especially me, is that, you know, everything has to be fact-based. So you feel you have to have everything like a term paper. You have to prove everything. And that's fine because, look, baseball has a lot of narratives that have been debunked, especially over the last two decades. But what I think, not only with Fastball John, but with Cobra, what you're trying to do, and I think we need more of it, is good storytelling. You could still do storytelling. You could still, and I'm sure Dave's memory, although I know he has some health issues, anybody, even the most erudite person, you know, myself, you know, you don't remember everything perfectly from 5 years ago, 10 days ago. You know, sometimes you get things wrong, but that doesn't mean it takes away from the storytelling. And I think throughout this book, you know, and we're doing a Mets connection here, but there's so many stories and ways that you can enjoy the game. I feel like it's being lost because everything now is, you know, rankings and numbers. And look, I do the same thing too. I just did it in the press segment when we were talking about Jacob deGrom and where he stands in terms of his career and how his career has taken a different trajectory. Yeah. But I think you're trying to bring back that storytelling a little bit, it sounds like, in the last two books and specifically here with Cobra.
You know, it almost seems like in the modern game, in the modern baseball community, that certain folks would rather lose the right way than win in their minds the wrong way. And I think that's an issue.
That's interesting. So basically when you say lose the right way, you know, when you have a team, and it's interesting because Dave had this long career, and even the Pirates were known as a bad team, and they became bad in the mid to, you know, mid 80s. And then they had their turnaround with Bonds and Bonilla and what have you.
Yeah.
But even those bad Pirates teams, I don't think they were trying to lose. I think they brought in a lot of veterans. If you look, they had some good veteran starting pitchers, John Tudor being one of them. Mm-hmm. Things didn't work out. It doesn't seem throughout his career he ever was on a team that was actively looking not to win. Even teams like those Pirate teams, you know, when he went to, Milwaukee, they weren't great. He never was on a team that was tanking. I don't know if he had any observation about even the teams that didn't feel like they could win at all. There was still a feel like, hey, let's go out there. Let's try to compete and win. And, you know, even though you might win 82 games, 82 versus 77 doesn't necessarily change the draft so much, but in the minds of some fans, like, you know, you got to lose less to get a higher pick. Well, they didn't have that mindset back then.
No, but I'll tell you what was interesting about the Milwaukee story, and we're going to probably publish something on that. We don't really go into it too much in the book just because it's a 480-page book, you know, so we had to cut a few things here and there. But basically, the Brewers were kind of held over a barrel by Robin Yount because he was a free agent at the time. And he basically, in the winter of 1989, he basically said, you guys have 2 weeks to figure something out and to show me that you're committed to winning because the Angels just offered me a huge contract. And he was talking to Gene Autry at the time. Robin Yount had some real estate interests in Southern California and the West Coast. And Autry's wife was allegedly a real estate whiz. So they were helping him with his land investments. And he basically went to Bud Selig, you got to do something. to show me that, you know, otherwise I'm gone. And they ended up offering Dave Parker a very generous contract. And meanwhile, Parker didn't want to leave Oakland. But Oakland was only willing, after they won the series in 89, Oakland was only willing to give him one extra year. And for, you know, reasons that, that, you know, we talk about in the book, Parker needed a little more than that. And the Brewers gave him 2 years plus an option, plus a bonus. And the other thing was they wanted Parker, after the work that he had done with Eric Dave, with young players like Eric Davis, Cal Daniels, Barry Larkin, and the guys in Oakland, for less, to a lesser degree, Canseco and McGuire, that Parker was perceived as one of the best mentors in baseball. And the Brewers had a young player named Gary Sheffield that they wanted a mentor like Parker to kind of, quote unquote, raise him. And that's why he went to Milwaukee.
And Yount wound up declining precipitously after that 89 season.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. That would have went down as an epic bad contract for at that time, the California Angels. Dave Jordan, author of the book Cobra. There's two really cool Mets moments that I think the fans would enjoy that involve Dave Parker. One, he got hit by the dude, and he got sent to the disabled list by the dude, and everybody knows that's not Lenny Dykstra. Everybody knows the monster's out of the cage. Some of the younger fans know him as John Stearns. And then I think what's funny, and I'm curious to hear his thoughts because he probably vividly remembers it, that game in 86 where he dropped the fly ball. A lot of Met connections in that game.
Yes.
Gianfranco on the mound. Dave Parker drops the fly ball. Big brawl between Ray Knight and Eric Davis next innings. Mets go on winning. That game was almost a synopsis of the 86 Mets. I mean, that to me is it encapsulates that magical season and that team and some of the breaks they got, but also some of the grit that that team had. So those two events, you know, I'm curious what he remembered about getting hit by John Stearns, sometimes an underrated figure in Mets history. And then, of course, the game where he extended it by dropping a routine fly ball in 1886, Mets Reds, the brawl.
What happened in 78 was basically the Pirates gave up like 3 runs in the eighth inning. It's a 6-3 game. And in the top, in the bottom of the ninth, they're in Pittsburgh. There's 30,000 people there for fireworks night. So that's a really good crowd in at Three Rivers at the time. And Parker basically hits a 2-run triple over Lenny Randle's head into the corner. Couple guys score. It's 6-5. There's one out. Bill Robinson coming to the plate. And the place is rocking, you know, much like Shea in 73. Robinson hits a fly ball to Joel Youngblood in right. And remember, Youngblood, you know it. We know it. All Met fans of the 70s know he had a rocket for an arm. Not everybody in the majors knew it at this point. And Parker standing on third, the fly ball to right, he looked over at Stearns, and all Stearns did was troll him with a smile. And basically, Parker just got pissed. And he's like, I'm going to run over this guy. Because, you know, throughout 78, Parker had been running over guys. He put Reggie Baldwin, a rookie catcher with the Astros, in a, almost like a, you know, concussion. And Youngblood catches the ball, and the infielders are screaming. And he tosses it to home plate, and Parker just rolls in. And there is this photo that the Hall of Fame has of Parker just before he hits Stearns, and he's got a smile on his face. And he basically said something like, smile, MF-er. And then he doesn't remember anything for like 10 hours.
Wow. And that to me, I mean, many people have been hit by John Stearns, big guy. Yeah. And Dave Parker's a big guy. Now, the 86 one, I got to think, because I think I remember there being a quote, and I couldn't find it. Dave Parker hated that team, as well as a lot of the Reds. A lot of people around the league hated that team. And I think that game really stuck in that team's craw. Now, the Reds, if you remember, were kind of like the ultimate bridesmaids for a while. Pete Rose, the manager, good team, just couldn't get out of their way in the West, whether it be the Dodgers beating them, the Astros, the Giants. They were a team that was good, just missing that piece. Yeah. And I'm sure that they wanted to prove themselves against this, you know, burgeoning dynasty from New York. So what did he remember about that? And obviously about the most routine fly ball that you could ever see Dave Parker drop out there in right field.
Yeah, he just dropped the ball. He just dropped it. He closed his glove too quick. He dropped it. And then he owned it. He apologized to Franco. Johnny Franco was on the mound. He apologized to Franco when he got back to the dugout. Pete didn't say a word. And later, you know, what happened was, you know, there was the brawl where basically Pete went in as a pinch hitter and he got on base. Eric Davis, you know, ran for him, stole second. and he was going to steal third, and he gets up, and he had some words previously with Ray Knight, and then when he kind of stood up on his slide, Ray Knight touched him, then he touched him back, and then Eric Gregg, the umpire, grabs Davis, and Ray Knight kind of sucker punched him.
Yep.
Then all hell broke loose, and then after the Mets ultimately win that game, and the Reds go back to the clubhouse, Parker just turns to Eric Davis like, "Go home, son. This is on me. I'll take the brunt of everything."
Wow, interesting leadership being shown there, and that was the thing, you know, Dave Parker, and I think that's something that is starting to be overlooked a little bit as we get into the world of analytics. And look, guys are expensive as they get older, and you know, I said to a lot of people, you know, you saw some players retire or fade off into the sunset. Part of that could be, you know, pandemic baseball is not for them, and you know, the last couple of years of their career, they don't want to deal with that. But part of that is it's also the value, you know. Look, a lot of money to these guys that they're turning down, with a lot of money to us, it's not worth the grind out there. And even later in his career, Dave Parker, he went to Toronto, he was in California at some point. Those kind of veterans, even when they only play part-time, I wonder if we're missing something today, because I don't know if Dave Parker gets a job after 88 in today's game. I don't. You know what I'm saying? I think sometimes they may look at him as, you know, expensive, I could do better, younger guy. It's a shame, but Dave Parker was that kind of guy that, you know, he played very late into his career and was acquired by Toronto as a veteran presence in a division or postseason run.
Yeah, well, it was also the manager at the time, Cito Gaston, who was one of Parker's. He was his teammate for about a week in Pittsburgh in 78, but more important, he was his teammate for a couple of years in Winter League. And they were very close in winter baseball. And it's funny how you look at stats on Baseball Reference and you look at rosters like, oh, these guys played together. And you don't realize back in the day how many of them often played together overseas, or they played together in the winter leagues. And that's where a lot of these relationships get formed. You know, a great prospect from the mid-70s, Mitchell Page, or as Parker calls him, Mitch Page, was a big prospect in the Pirates organization. And you wouldn't know it from looking at his baseball card, but he was very, very close with Dave Parker in the winter of 76 because they played in Venezuela together. They were running buddies. And Parker was very upset when Page was involved in the Phil Garner deal. And he got extremely upset about that because here was my burgeoning best friend who just gets shipped off so we can get a third baseman when they all thought Bill Robinson was going to be playing third for the Pirates in 77. So it's a lot of these relationships that people don't realize exist there. And Cito Gaston definitely wanted Parker there for that, to get one last sip of champagne.
When Francisco Lindor signed his big contract, they kept telling everybody, you know, and I've had Mike Piazza on the show. I've spoken to him about it on this program. When you have those expectations of being the man and either you're waiting to get the money or you've gotten the money, things change. Every player's told me, you know, even though you've gotten your due and you've gotten the money and you're happy and the team showed you that respect, walking into that clubhouse, things change. Parker had that a couple of times in his career. Had it, obviously, the Pirates, and that didn't sit well with the very blue-collar Pittsburgh fans when, you know, he got that big contract. And maybe they didn't manage the expectations of who he was. He was still a very good player, but maybe they wanted him to be better. And then he went to Cincinnati. And not that he had a bad career in Cincinnati, but it certainly wasn't Hall of Fame level like he was in Pittsburgh. And I'm curious if he talked about that, because it's going to be a big topic around the Mets this year because of Conforto looking to get his money and starting off slow, and Lindor getting his money and starting off slow. And I think Parker's a great guy that could speak to some of that, because he experienced that in an era when free agency was just starting and money was eye popping. Maybe we're a little desensitized to the money at this point, but back then we were not.
I'm gonna actually say that, you know, Parker's time in Cincinnati was pretty incredible insofar as he helped reshape the spirit mentality of the Big Red Machine. I mean, he gets there as a free agent to start the 1984 season. You know, the organization is on the verge of getting getting their third owner within 4 years, and that's something I don't think has been topped yet.
Smart shot, a wacky owner.
But basically, you know, they had nothing with the exception of their GM, Dick Wagner, just been dismissed. who had done some decent, made some decent strides with bringing in, you know, drafting some talent, whether it was, you know, Eric Davis and Cal Daniels, Paul O'Neill, Tom Browning, a couple others, Tracy Jones was another one they liked. They were very high on. But Parker instilled the winning attitude with those players. And you can hear Paul O'Neill even talk about it sometimes. For the most part, he had some great seasons. I mean, they'll talk about, you know, the fact that he didn't walk and whatnot. But they don't talk about that. They'll say his defense was terrible. He was fifth in assists in 1980.
He had a great arm. Great arm. Cannon. Yeah.
He had a cannon, and he was still a presence in the outfield in terms of his you know, just being there, and a presence in the lineup. They basically went from a laughing stock in the early in 82, 83. In 84, they started rebuilding. 6 years later, they had a world championship with that core nucleus that Parker helped raise.
Did he talk about the challenges of getting the money, coming off the 79 season? He won a gold glove. I mean, this guy was elite offensive player, high average, power, drove in runs. He struck out a lot, but he also walked a lot. His on-base percentage was, you know, shade under 400. These are elite offensive numbers, even by today's standards. Mm-hmm. And, he was very good, Dave, very good. But there's a big drop-off in totality after 79. Was it part of it, this pressure of, in a blue-collar town, he's an African-American player, getting big money when players were starting to get big money and the fans didn't like it because now the separation began? Did he talk about that impacting him and maybe carrying over to some of his, you know, small drop-off nonetheless, but going from elite to very good probably after the 79 season?
What happened after the 79 season was that his injuries caught up to him. Dave Parker, and we talk about what a gift he was to Major League Baseball, but if Dave Parker had never gotten injured in high school, he would have been in the NFL. He was the top running back prospect in the Cincinnati area in going to the 69-70, his senior year of high school. And he was already having, you know, Ohio State was looking at him, Penn State was looking at him, Michigan, a lot of schools in Michigan, you know, University of Michigan, Michigan State, Western Michigan, they were all looking at Dave Parker for their backfield. And basically, it really came down to his injury. He tore his knee in like 3, 4, or 5 places as a high school senior. He had 2 or 3 surgeries. And they basically said, your football career is done. It's over.
Wow.
But you can try baseball and you can play baseball, but it's going to catch up to you at some point. It caught up to him in 1980. And that's really what the issues were with what he had going on. It was the injuries, and he had some interesting methods of pain management that, you know, never really became a personal issue for him, but he was trying to work through that for a couple of years. He had another surgery in 1980. He had another surgery in 81. And, he finally started to get better by 1983, but he was very, he had so many injuries in those three seasons and trying to rehab and figure out how to play with those knees. Those knees were never the same. And he just,
turf, majority of his career on turf. What we know now, that probably was the worst possible thing for him. He didn't have the opportunity like Andre Dawson to leave and go to Wrigley Field and get off. I mean, Andre Dawson, it was probably late for him too, but he got away. He got away from Montreal and the hard concrete and things like that. Hey, but before we wrap up, I had mentioned the Hall of Fame and Dave Parker. You'd have a chance to really sit down with an all-time great player. Not many people have that opportunity. And I look, and I mentioned some of the names earlier, Buddy Bell, Keith Hernandez, Dewey Evans, Bobby Gritch. And are you now, I mean, because this is getting tricky. You know, I talked about Jacob deGrom earlier and how we can't just look in counting total stats.
Yeah.
We almost have to take the era and take the period of dominance or elite. You know, it used to be 10 years. You know, I don't know if Parker has 10 years of all-time elite dominance. And you don't want to make it into the Hall of Very Good, because that's the debate. But, you know, some of these names I just brought up, I'm starting to say, you know, when you go from 1974 to 1987 and Keith Hernandez is fifth all-time and wins above replacement, and he's not in the Hall of Fame, that's an era. That's a significant era. Now, Dave Parker's top 50 during that era, and he's comparable to Tim Raines and Reggie Jackson and what have you. Have you As we wrap up here, have you rethought Parker for the Hall of Fame or maybe some other names that maybe he and you talked about as well while you were doing this project?
What I told Dave and what Dave basically, you know, we talked about in terms of we didn't make the book about that. And, you know, because he knows he wakes up, he goes to bed every night, and he wakes up every morning. He's the Cobra. And he can go up to Cooperstown and walk into any party at the Oat Saga with a bunch of Hall of Famers, and they know who he is, and they treat him as such with that reverence, you know. But I believe that the mentality behind the voting needs to change, and I'll tell you why. The voting, as per the rules of the BBWAA, shall be based upon the player's record, his playing ability, integrity, sportsmanship, character, and contributions to the teams in which the player played. And he was the most, Dave Parker was the most talented player in the game for 5 seasons. He was drafted as a catcher. There aren't too many guys in the hall who came in as a catcher and converted to another position and became an elite defender. Basically, he had 26 assists in right field after putting on an outfielder's glove for the first time. That's elite playing ability. And with all of the advancements in nutrition and technology and just basic health for athletes, nobody's ever come close to touching that since like 1978.
Wow. And you know what? The Veterans Committee probably will start to give some of these guys, Dave, a real consideration. I know that they're not going to like their era being snuffed out. And I know that I think in 2023, that era, the modern era, will come up again. Mm-hmm. And the hope is that, you know, reading your book, reading books like this, starting to get back and really taking away just not the baseball reference. That's a big part of it. You have to use it. But then you got to take that and transfer it to what you just said in context. Hopefully we see more of that. Hopefully the Veterans Committee could do a little bit of that.
Dave Parker, more than nearly any player in the last half century, has been cited by more star players for his guidance, his nurturing, his encouragement, basically the time he spent raising young players. Again, Eric Davis, Cal Daniels, you know, Sheffield, lesser degree, McGuire and Canseco, and Barry Larkin. This is just an anecdote, but Barry Larkin, Hall of Fame shortstop, not only insisted that Parker and his wife travel with him to Cooperstown when he was elected, but he stayed the weekend in the same rented house. Larkin made certain that Parker was seated up front and made sure to tell the 50,000 fans in attendance how vital Dave Parker was to his career.
Right. That's leadership. That's something that I think some teams are missing. And a lot of that could be traced back to money, of course, and analytics. So, Dave, what's next, buddy? Cobra, great book. Fastball John is another book that if those in the audience haven't read yet, you should check it out. Totally different type of project. A lot of storytelling and really interesting stuff that you're not seeing as much in today's journalism. So, Dave, what's next for you? Let the listeners know what they could find you and events and all the other fun stuff.
Well, we've been doing a number of interviews in support of the book, which you can find Barnes & Noble, Cobra, A Life of Baseball and Brotherhood. And you can find it obviously on Amazon. And also if you wanted to buy an autographed copy from Parker, you can go to the Dave Parker 39 Foundation where they sell autographed copies of the book. But otherwise, you know, we're waiting to see what's next. And I'm looking at a couple of projects that have been brought to my attention, and it'll probably be another, you know, another book with an athlete or a celebrity or something like that. But it'll be something with a different spin on what you know about them. So I look forward to bringing that to everyone.
Well, Dave, listen, you've always been a good friend of the show. You do great work. And even though it's a Pirate Reds project, there's tons of Mets anecdotes and ways to connect to the modern game. So I appreciate you coming on. And let's do this again, my friend.
Absolutely, Mike. Thanks so much for having me.
Dave Jordan, author of the book Cobra. Interesting stuff. Like I said, I try to do something different. I try to have conversations. I try to have a guest that flows this along. I can't spend, you know, an hour plus complaining about the Mets offense or, you know, railing against injustices in the media. You gotta have some good baseball talk. All right, let's take a quick break, wrap up. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this. The Talking Mets podcast is available on many outlets, but the most popular is Apple Podcast. Hi, I'm Mike Silva, the host of the Talking Mets podcast, and I encourage you to leave a review about the program on Apple. Just rate it 1 to 5 stars, hopefully a 5 because why wouldn't you? And then if you have time, leave a review. It helps the podcast continue to grow and encourages others to take a listen. You can also email me at mikesilva@mikesilva.com. TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G. TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Hope to hear from you soon and enjoy the rest of the show. All right, final thoughts. I hope you guys enjoyed a little back and forth between me and Dave Jordan, author of the book Cobra. I know Dave Parker's not a Mets figure, but there was some really interesting Mets connections. And I thought in general, bringing somebody on from outside the whole Mets community, sometimes you get different perspectives. And I always enjoy hearing Dave's perspective. Guy that's really dived into analytics and sabermetrics, but also really good at storytelling. And that's one of the commitments I'm trying to make here, is to continue to balance the storytelling with fact and try to be as well-rounded on this show as possible. I know that by doing that, sometimes you alienate both of the extremes of both type of listeners. I mean, the hardcore analytics guys aren't listening to this show. They're not going to respect this show. They're not going to like the show. And I'm never going to make them happy. So that's the thing. I've never done this show as a way to make a specific group or person happy. I've put the product out as best as I know, and I believe by doing that, you'll get the largest audience. Maybe you compromise some overall, and I'm trying to think of the right word, reach that you can get, but I believe if you pretend to be something that you're not, everybody's going to see through that, and you won't make anybody happy, and then you wind up going out of business here. You know, you get off the air, so it is what it is. Hey, before I wrap up, I wanted to say a couple of quick thank yous, long overdue thank yous to some listeners on the Chevy Chase at Chevy underscore Chase. And back in early April, said he was looking forward to this week's show from Australia. So we got fans down under. So welcome aboard. And John Luby at John underscore Luby on Twitter, also in Australia. I don't know if Chevy Chase and John Luby are, and I hope I pronounced your names correctly. I don't know if they're the only, you know, they're two buddies that talk about the show in Australia, but Australia. Hopefully Crocodile Dundee's also listening. I'm just kidding. David Hans, also at David Hans 60 on Twitter, listener to the show. And Sounds Like Sudden at D Truds also listens to the show, and I wanted to thank him. Hopefully he's taking his kids to school, listening to this program and enjoying it. And hopefully we lived up to the expectations there. Also wanted to thank Ryan Mitchell for reaching out. Ryan Mitchell, a new listener to the show. And I hope I didn't miss anybody, but anytime somebody reaches out and talks about their experience with this program, I just want to say thank you. And I say this all the time, and I'll say it again because it's important. I take very seriously you spending an hour plus of your time invested in this. You can't get time back. You can't just unclick like an article or, you know, a 30-second video. So I try to make it as worthwhile, and I hope you walk away feeling like that time was well spent, whether it's taking your kids to school, walking your dog, you know, relaxing at the beach or in your backyard or just killing your commute. Whatever it is that you do, that you use this as your time in between, I hope it was worthwhile to you. So anyway, that's it. Another week of Mets baseball ahead of us. I want to thank Dave Jordan again, author of the book Cobra. Check it out. Great stuff over there. Of course, you could check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you get the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with another program pretty soon. Till then, be well, everybody.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.